So what I want to do is to discuss the dynamics of selectivity in macaque V1. And I'm mainly going to be talking about orientation selectivity, although I will, at one point, there'll be some stuff about other things, mainly spatial frequency selectivity. But I think that although there's been a lot of focus on orientation selectivity, that it's useful to understand it because it's a key to understanding a lot of other things. That is to say, if we can understand that, we can also understand a lot of other things that the cortex is doing, the visual cortex is doing. And so it's kind of like a test case. It fell asleep, that's all. I think. Yeah. Yeah, sorry. So let's see. So this is just some, not a very impressive picture of some data, but the data were hard to get and are impressive, on what neurons in V1 look like. These are actually three different tuning curves from neurons in the input layer of the cortex, 4C alpha. And I realize some of the slides, a lot of the slides assume that you're all very conversant with the laminar pattern of organization of V1. So let me just talk about 4C alpha and the other layers for a second. I don't have a slide of it. In fact, let's, maybe I'll just draw that here. It may be trivial, but maybe it's worth just making sure that we know. Oh, okay. Yeah, actually we don't need the screen all that much, but it's true. So if you have, if this is the top of the cortex and this is the bottom, this is the, out to the outside world, and this is the white matter. This is the skull, and this is the white matter. And these are all the little gray cells that are important for vision. Anatomists have divided it into layers, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6. But actually, it turns out that layer 4 in the monkey is divided up into many sublayers. And it's a lot of where there's a lot of action. So there's 4A, B, C. And in 4C, there are two subdivisions, alpha and beta. And beta. And 4C alpha is where the magno input from the LGN comes in. And 4C beta is where the parvo input from the LGN comes in. So these are actually the input layers. The input sort of comes into the middle of the cortex, and then it goes up into these layers 2, 3. 1 is a really rather thin cell-free layer. So 2, 3 is where there are a lot of pyramidal cells that are output to the rest of the cortex. And 5 and 6 are output layers, also going feedback and feed-forward inputs to the colliculus and to the geniculate and so on. And 4C is the input, are where the input layers are. 4B, just above 4C alpha, so just above 4C alpha, is an output layer that goes to V2 and also to MT and has a lot of direction selective cells. 4A is a sort of unknown layer. It's very thin, difficult to record from. And 2 and 3 are output layers that go to the rest of the cortex and are supposed to be to V2 and so on, and are supposed to be involved with vision and visual perception. So the input layers are mainly, there is some input to 6, but it's mainly into 4C alpha and beta. And these are three neurons from alpha. And there's a whole diversity of response, but these are kind of, so these span the range of what you find in 4C alpha. You find some cells that are very sharply tuned or very selective for orientation, and there are others that are more broadly tuned, like this direction selective cell is sort of fairly broadly tuned, and here's another broadly tuned orientation selective neuron. So one of the things that we find is that there's orientation tuning, even in the input layer, in 4C, but it's very, there's a diversity of tuning. There are some very broadly tuned cells and some very narrowly tuned cells, And this is a result of a model which I'll just briefly discuss, and we can talk about, you know, out of off official time later. But the main thing I wanted to use the slide for is just to show that there's tuning curves in 4C, and that there are and that there's diversity. Yeah.
90 and 270 degrees are different because we are moving.
That's right. These are drifting grading patterns. So these are measurements, and a lot of the things I'll be telling you about are average measurements over several cycles of a uniformly drifting grading in one direction or another. So 90 and 270 are opposite directions. So this one here is a direction selective cell, and that it's responding more at 90 than it is at 270. And not all neurons in 4C alpha respond best at 90. These are just three that are sort of chosen, they're lined up at 90, but there's all different preferred orientations. That there's a dense representation of preferred.
But at least 0 and 360 should be
the same. Yes.
They don't seem to
be. Well, that's just sloppiness in drawing or something. I don't know. Well, this is the last point, and then it'll go up to this point here when it comes around. So, yeah, because they are the same point. I mean, they're not separately measured through 0 and 360. So this was the last measured point, and then the plot stopped. So that's a small thing. So the thing is, what I'm going to tell you is that you need. So the whole rest of the talk is going to be about mechanisms of how you get these kinds of selectivities. And one thing you should know is that if you look at, these are the results of single cell recordings. So this is a single cell recording from a neuron in one of these layers that's now covered by the screen. And we record, you know, from many neurons and try to get an idea of the population properties. But if you record from a single cell in the LGN, you don't get anything like this. Basically, the curve is just flat. So there's a change of the way that the spatial patterns are represented when you come into V1, and the question is, how does that happen?
One more question about this curve. Some of them are sort of playing on some baseline, which is
correct. Absolutely, that's a very important observation.
To appreciate what it means, you need to know what the cell does when there is no.
So these cells and most cells in V1 have very low maintained activities, between 0 and 5 spikes a second. This is just the responses during the drift. But in fact, and in spikes per second, as David McLaughlin added. So these numbers are spikes per second. But in fact, the maintained rates, if you're not stimulating, if you just have a uniform screen, are in the range of this tick mark or below. So they tend to have a very low maintained firing rate. And these are all elevations above. Yeah. So when there's a baseline, this is a baseline of activity, driven activity. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's a very important point, actually.
I see emission because some people say that if you stimulate with orthogonal orientation, there is emission. But this,
well, we do see inhibition when we elevate the maintained rate by using the reverse correlation technique. So I'm going to talk about that.
Directly, you don't see the activity going down for some orientation.
So you can see that in cells that have a high maintained rate. So, you know, like everything else, maintained rate is distributed across the population. The mean is about 5. It's very highly skewed towards 0. But there are some that respond have maintained rates that are higher. And in those few cells, you can see inhibition, definitely. And it is nice to see it. But you can show inhibition more directly by having some driven response and then causing inhibition to occur with an orthogonal orientation. So there are a lot of experiments, and we've begun doing. This will fall asleep again, but don't worry about it. We've been doing some experiments recently where what you do is, in fact, you have two orientations, say like that, where this is the preferred orientation and this is, say, close to orthogonal, and then you can see a lot of inhibition due to the orthogonal. So, I mean, there's no question that you can get inhibition from the orthogonal. It's just a question of whether you can see it against the maintained activity or not, because it's so low usually. That's the problem. It's like a floor. You can't see below the floor. Okay, so this is just the introduction to the data, the kind of data that we get. Just to point out, when you have an orientation tuning curve like this, there's a preference, that's the preferred orientation, And then there's the amount of selectivity. And you can measure selectivity in different ways. And actually, some of the confusion in the field is because of different ways of measuring selectivity. So there's, that is to say, there, we could say there's not very much confusion in the field. But whatever confusion there is, part of it is due to people talking past each other about the different kinds of way that they're measuring selectivity. So classically, a lot of people use bandwidth, which is just the, if you take the peak and you measure halfway down from the peak to the base, or halfway down from the peak to the base, what will be the width of the curve? And then often people take the half width of that as the half bandwidth. Or the bandwidth at half height, they'll take the full bandwidth at half height. So there'll be different terms for this term, which is basically what's the shape of the peak and what's the shape of the tuning around the peak. But other people like us use this circular variance, which is misspelled, sorry. It's haste makes waste. I could fix it, but anyway, it's circular variance. Whoops. See, it didn't even like my misspelling. That's terrible. And so circular variance, spelled correctly here, is just a measure of relative modulation. And what it is 1 minus the best fitting Fourier component that sort of captures the orientation selectivity. It's actually not that. It's the Fourier component that captures the modulation in orientation divided by the sort of integrated length of all the vectors around the clock. So this is like a relative modulation. So that's why it's a measure of height to trough of the orientation tuning curve. It's the relative modulation of the tuning curve. And then you subtract that from 1 to get something which is more like what textbooks call circular variance. M here is just the firing rate. So this is the circular variance of the firing rate as a function of theta, is this. And if the relative modulation is high, then the circular variance is low, and that means that the neuron is very selective. So that means that there's a lot of modulation of the tuning curve with theta. But if there's very little modulation of the tuning curve with theta, so that this number here is close to 0, then the circular variance will be close to 1, because it's 1 minus this relative modulation. And so poorly tuned neurons have high circular variances, close to 1. So circular variance is a number between 1 and 0 that's an index of sort of orientation selectivity. Because that's what they do in the textbooks for circular variance. It's a way of, how to put it, if there's very little modulation, then that means that all of the vectors are sort of equally long. So there's a lot of variance of the vectors from compared to 0. Whereas if there's only 1 vector, there's not very little variance. So that's why it's called circular variance. Yeah, sorry.
So these are kind of implicitly assumes a cosine. I'm not sure why one uses this measure.
It's one measure of, you know, thousands you could choose. It's just one that's classical.
It does not disentangle the shape of the tuning curve from its.
Well, the thing is that it's related to the shape of the tuning curve to some extent. That is, you can see that, you know, narrow. I'll show you some data about this. That narrower bandwidths tend to have lower circular variances, but then this also is sensitive to how high the pedestal is compared to the.
It mixes the two factors into that one.
Well, it's a measure of sort of relative modulation, so it mixes two factors. That's right, because it's how modulated it is compared to the steady value around the clock. On the other hand, unlike bandwidth really throws away one of the factors. It's completely sensitive only to local things, whereas this is sensitive to global things. This is not, I'm not sure that there is an optimal measure. This may not be the optimal measure, but it's a measure that's been used and that we've used a lot. And I think that one could come up with, you know, as I say, 7 different such measures before lunch. The question just is, you know, what sort of things do you see in the data with using these different measures? Sebastian Sung and Heinz Sampolinski had another measure, which was information, which was somewhat related to this relative modulation measure, but was different. And you could generate lots of different measures. And the question is, what do you get out of them? So there's another question. Yeah.
Does this definition get confused if the cells are directional
selective? It could do, but it doesn't. You just apply this measure if they're direction selective or not, and you get a number. In general, what we did with direction selective cells was just apply this as if we just applied it, I mean, mechanically. Indeed, you could say that using this measure only on direction selective cells may underestimate their orientation selectivity, but in any case, you get a number and you can just use it. So that's an issue for direction. It is an important point for direction selective cells that you may be diluting out their selectivity by averaging the sort of flat part compared to the modulated part. Anything else? Right. I mean, there are very different ways we do it, but that's certainly how it looks. Right. The circular variance is what I'd like to refer to as a global measure, because it's taking into account the whole tuning curve. That is to say, the integrals over all of the measured points. Bandwidth is a local measure. It's really looking at what's going on right around the peak. And the two different measures are similar, but they co-vary, but they're not perfectly correlated. And I think I can show you some data about that. No, I'm going to show you something else first. Then I'm going to show you the relationship between bandwidth and circular variance. Sorry. So the thing is that you see some things with circular variance that you don't see with bandwidth. And two things that we see are the difference between so-called simple and complex cells and also the wide diversity of orientation selectivity across V1. And then I'll show you why you might not see that using bandwidth. So bandwidth has been used as a measure to study orientation selectivity. And what people have found is that there's a fairly narrow bandwidth distribution. People like Russ Diveloy and Peter Schiller have done this in monkey previously, measuring bandwidth distributions across a large population of cells in V1 and seeing what the bandwidths look like. And they find that, you know, there's this featureless, somewhat skewed distribution, and that simple and complex cells are more or less the same. However, when you use circular variance, you get a rather different picture. If you look at simple cells, and I'll tell you in a second how they're defined, you get this sort of bimodal distribution of circular variance. And if you look at complex cells, you see this very unimodal distribution of circular variance. And furthermore, the means are quite different. The mean of the simple cell distribution the mean circular variance is below 0.5, and the mean circular variance for the complex cells is about 0.7, 0.65, 0.7. So they're substantially different. So there are a number of things to discuss with respect to this graph. Number one, what's the data set? It's a data set like I showed you before. It's average steady state responses to drifting grading patterns. Okay? No, this is the whole cortex. Now we're jumping to the whole cortex just because we can't. This is a lot of cells. This is like 300 cells. And we only have about 40 to 50 cells in 4C alpha, but we have 300 cells over the whole cortex. So it took about 3 or 4 years to get that many cells.
Probably differently distributed across the
layer. We have some data about this. The problem is we don't have enough numbers to get statistics. We have some data about that, actually. I could show you that later, offline.
Yeah, but what I was to say is that you don't know if it's the difference is due to the complex versus simple or just because they're in the different layers.
So we have some data about that also, which I'll address later. But I just wanted to show this result because it's an unusual result and it has some consequences for our attitudes about what's going on in the cortex. So that's why I showed it. But indeed, you're right. There may be some things we want to discuss about why it comes out this way. Just to short-circuit your anxieties, I'll just say that it isn't really a laminar difference. It does seem to be a difference between the cell types because this sort of difference seems to be present in all the layers that we can measure simple and complex cells together. But I'm hesitant to say much about that because of the numbers. It's statistics of small numbers, except for the whole population. But there's no evidence that it's a laminar difference. So let me get back to how we did these experiments. This is, each cell was recorded for something like, you know, well, hours usually, but for this experiment, you know, 5 minutes or something. And you measure around the clock the orientation selectivity, the orientation responses for drifting grading patterns at an optimal spatial frequency, temporal frequency, high contrast, and you get the average spike rate for each condition, and then you get a tuning curve like the ones I showed you, calculate the circular variance, and put it in the histogram. So that's where this histogram comes from. And these are all, I should say, so you know it, monkeys that are anesthetized with a narcotic, sufentanil, and so they're lightly anesthetized and sort of basically going back and forth between a sort of a drowsy awake, drowsy asleep, lots of V1 is very highly reactive and sensitive. So the thing is, what we see is that the simple and complex cells look very different. And in fact, there seems to be a group of very highly tuned simple cells, that is, very selective simple cells, and then a bunch of broadly selective ones that are sort of like the complex cells, which are kind of more broadly selective. And what it looks like is that the simple and complex cells are really quite different with respect to their orientation selectivity. And now, simple and complex are defined, or in these experiments, they were defined by, maybe I need to set this differently. Do it twice. Yeah. The simple cells and complex cells were defined by another measure of the spike rate as a function of time, which was how modulated was the spike rate to one of these drifting grading patterns. So complex cells tend to respond when you drift a grading pattern across their receptive field with just an elevation of the spike rate. And the simple cells respond with a modulated response as a function of time. And you can make a quantitative estimate of how modulated is the response and group all the cells that are really modulated into the simple cell group and all the cells that are sort of not modulated into the complex cell group. And so that's what was done here. So these are cells that are basically doing some kind of fairly strong nonlinear operation on the visual pattern, and these cells are actually fairly faithful to the image, as it were. They're responding closely to what the image looks like. And so anyway, this is a relatively new finding. I don't think anyone else knows about this except for us and a few other people, and the people who attended a recent scientific meeting that it was announced at. It shows that with this kind of measure, you see something that you don't see with bandwidth, which is that the simple and complex cells are rather different. Yeah?
The two modes of the simple cell correspond to direction selective and non-direction
selective? I don't think so. I think that there are plenty of non-direction selective cells that are selective as well. But I think that you could... I think that it's not simply that, but it's a good question.
One more question about the previous graph. So you say you do the steady state, so you average over the whole time.
That's right.
And if you took the simple cells and only looked at the peak of the response, where this is a high.
Well, so the simple cell response can be measured in a couple of different ways, because since it's modulated, you can look at the Fourier component at the modulation frequency, and that completely covaries with the mean rate in the simple cell. Same curve. We've done that actually, and it's the same. So Misha is saying that with a simple cell, because it's modulated, you could use other measures than just the spike rate. Just the mean spike rate during the time of the stimulation. You could use the modulation. So we do that, and it comes. There's a perfect correlation between that measure and just the mean spike rate.
During the deep in the activity.
Yeah. Right. Exactly. That's right. Okay. So I wanted to just show you across the layers. It isn't too informative, but because it looks like a mess, and that's really the message of this slide. Is that if you look across the layers, the simple cells are in red and the complex cells are in blue, and this is circular variance. So this is the same. This is sort of unbundling the plot from the previous slide and distributing across the layers. And so these are the layers that I drew for you before. Remember, 4C, alpha is the layer above. That's maybe you can just see the indistinct dashed lines, and 4C beta is the one below. And what you find is that basically it just looks like noise. It isn't really noise because there is some, if you look at the median of the distribution of the dots as a function of depth, there are sort of places where the circular variance is particularly bad, like in layer 5 and in layer 3b. And there is some kind of gradation of selectivity as you go from 4c to 4b. You get better in 4b. But as you can see, just looking at the scatter plot, that's the population, but there's the variance is large. The variance of the circular variance is large. And you can do a similar graph for bandwidth, and you get pretty much the same thing. And what this is saying to us is that the orientation selectivity in V1, this is V1 of monkey, is not really a very tightly distributed, narrowly distributed property, but in fact, it's very broadly distributed. And the word that our touchstone word is diversity. There's a lot of diversity in the population. And so it seems to me that one of the things that theorists should be concerned about is not only accounting for selectivity, but also for diversity of selectivity. And generally, physiologists have tended not to tell theorists about this because they think they're ashamed of it, that it's a mess, and it's messy, and it's dirty, and it's not a clean story. But in fact, I think nowadays, if we're grown up and we're tolerant of mess, that in fact, biology is messy, and we should try to understand, is there some order in the mess? That is to say, can we account for the diversity from some theoretical understanding? And I think the answer to that is yes, and that in fact, the experimentalists' shame in discussing the messy diversity has actually impeded progress in understanding what's going on in the cortex. There is actually quite a range of properties in each of these dimensions, and in fact, theory should be aware of it and try to account for it. Yeah?
So you said 4C, 4B, 4A is in each layer?
4B, sorry, 4A is actually both an input and an output layer. It gets a little bit of input from Parvo and actually goes out to V2. 4B is a strong output layer going to V2 and MT.
Okay, so what about other layers like the 3A?
Yeah, okay. Good question. I didn't go into this, but 2 and 3A are output layers to V2. They're major output layers. No, they do not. 3B gets some LGN input and also strong ascending input, feedforward input from 4C. But it is not itself an output layer. It provides input then to 2 and 3A, which then are the output layers. So there's like a relay of information from the LGN and from 4C through to 3B into 2-3A. You with me? 5 gets a lot of input from 2-3 and then feeds back actually to 2-3 and also feeds down to the colliculus and to other non-cortical structures. 6 has a very strong feedback into 4C. And also feedback back to LGN. So 6 seems to be a major feedback layer. And there is also some 6 input to MT. So I mean, it's complicated. But generally, we tend to group them as 4C are the input layers mainly, and these other 5, 6, and 2, 3A are output layers. 3B and 5 to some extent have an intracortical, and 6 also have intracortical functions as well. Intra aerial functions within V1.
So in normal modeling of the V1 cell selectivity, people talk about LGN input and then arranging LGN in the geometric.
Indeed they do. Yeah. I'm going to talk about that in a second.
But what about other cells which do not get LGN?
Well, some of them get, all of the cells within their layer get a lot of lateral input from other cortical cells. And then also, 4B gets input from 4C. Whoops. Sorry. I'll have to deal with this later. 4B gets input from 4C. Whoops. Excuse me. 4B gets input directly from 4C alpha. That's like a direct ascending input. 3B also gets input from 4C alpha and beta, and then relays that up into 3A and 2. So there's relay of visual information through 4C into the upper layers. 5 and 6 have ascending dendrites that get input from all the layers, but then get direct input from 4C also. So there's the LGN input gets relayed to the other cortical layers through the cells in 4C. Okay?
So are this, like there was a work proving that LGN inputs are somehow alive?
I was just about to talk, I'm going to talk about that.
Will you also talk about the same experiments in the cortex? Did anybody?
No, no one's done that in the cortex. That would be hard to do.
Harder
to do than the LGN, yeah. No, because when we talk about the experiments, we can discuss that. Because that's actually, you know, one of the issues is how you get the selectivity. But one of the things I wanted to say is that when you have a theory that accounts for selectivity, one of the things you'd like to have is also a theory that accounts for diversity. Now I wanted to get back to this issue of bandwidth versus circular variance. That is, why do we see all the stuff with the circular variance that you don't see with bandwidth? And at this point, I was going to exit my presentation. Let's see if I can really do this. Sorry. Where is it? It's, I have to move this thing around. Hold on a second. Here we go. Stop it. It's here someplace. Yeah, here we go. Good. Just be patient. That's probably good enough. Maybe we can zoom in just a bit. Okay, so this is a graph. I should say, by the way, that the stuff that I've been telling you is all experimental work that I've done, as I said on the first slide, with Dario Ringach and Mike Hawken. And so these, as I'm showing you these data, these are from papers that we're preparing for publication that Ringach and Hawken and I are preparing. It's basically stuff that's most of it, or not, I guess all of it is unpublished, but sort of some of it is about ready to come out and some of it is still being prepared. So this is recent stuff. And so this is circular variance plotted against bandwidth to try to give you an idea of what these different measures look like and what they measure. And there are also selected cells in this sort of main sequence to give you an idea of what different circular variances and different bandwidths look like. So for instance, if you look at these very low bandwidth, low circular variance cells like E, that sort of looks like a classic textbook case of an orientation selective cell that, you know, Hubel and Wiesel would be proud of. And the physiologists, other physiologists would be glad to show you. But then you see all these other varieties of cells. So F is another one down here that's sort of, you know, typical. But then you find cells, you know, like B, which is sort of up here, which has a fairly narrow bandwidth, but a pretty high circular variance. And the reason is that around the peak of the curve, it's fairly narrowly tuned, but it has a lot of responses also at off-peak orientations. So the circular variance is measuring both, is measuring this part, and the bandwidth is measuring this part, and so they don't covary that great for cells like that. Okay? And there are other ones that are like this. C's another one, I think, yeah, where you have a narrow peak sitting on a pedestal. And the maintained activity of both of them is down at zero. So these are driven responses above maintained. In these cases, the maintained here is the dashed line, which is just above zero. Here it's actually right in the axis. These are the maintained activities. Okay, here. So, and so you can see from the examples what tuning curves look like for these eight different cells, just chosen at random from this distribution. And indicating that the two measures covary, that is to say, they tend to, you know, they're correlated. There's, you could sort of draw something like that. But there's a lot of difference between them. Yeah?
So does this suggest that the orientation tuning for that cell, for example, is not contrast invariant?
That's a different issue, which I'll...
But it's related, right?
This is nothing to do with contrast. These are all high contrast. They're all different cells. These are all different cells.
One,
this is one cell at a time. Each of these is one cell at high contrast.
Okay.
The contrast is not in this picture at all.
No, I just turned by the baseline that it changes.
The baseline is the response when there's no pattern at all.
Oh, I see.
That's the pattern to a blank. That's the response to a blank. That's the maintained. So when I say maintained activity, it means response to a gray screen of the mean luminance of the pattern. That's what maintained activity means. Just to define the term. Yeah.
Previous studies often reported bandwidth between 20 and 40 degrees. So where large bandwidth?
Well, this is monkey. You're probably thinking of cat data. This distribution is just like the distributions. The bandwidth distribution that we find is exactly the same as Schiller and Develoy found 20 years ago. So it's, you know, it's invariant to experimenters, to laboratories, to techniques, to mean luminances, to everything. You get the same distribution. That's not an issue. The issue is that no one's measured this axis before, and so I'm trying to show you what the relationship between is the bandwidth distribution and the circular variance. I mean, our data on bandwidth are just like everybody else's. But what I'm saying is that they're not seeing, and we wouldn't see if we didn't look at other measures, other features of the tuning curves that are important. Yeah?
So there is a cluster for which the sample could not even define the bandwidth, a cluster of 9, right?
That's right, exactly.
So those are just only complex circuits.
You get both. It's just all a mess. Yeah, you get both. There are very broadly tuned simple and complex cells. And the curious thing is actually, to go back, you find them in many different layers. I mean, it's not just, so the story you get in the textbooks is different from this. But I just wanted to show you that, you know, that there's a lot of diversity in both bandwidth and circular variance. And you can see quite a bit more if you look at both than if you just look at one. I guess that's what I would say. You should definitely not be stuck on only one measure. Okay, so let me close this and go back to the PowerPoint if we can get back there. Thank you very much. It's so nice of you to tell me. Okay. Yeah, let me go back and just discuss this for a second. Hold on. One thing that people say is that in the monkey, this of course is all monkey data that I'm talking about. I'll refer to cat experiments along the way, but it's monkey data that we're discussing. They say that in 4C beta, that the cells are all orientation untuned, that they're circularly symmetric, and that as you go to other layers, the orientation tuning gets sharper. And in a sense, if you look at the average, we find some of that indicated in this these data. That is to say, the circular variance in 4C is a little higher, and it actually goes down as you go into 4B. But also, it goes up as you go into layer 5. That is to say, it isn't really true that the 4C cells are the worst tuned cells in the cortex, as it turns out, on average. And also, if you look, so these are the cells that are beyond 0.7. These are the cells that are really very poorly tuned for orientation. You find them in all layers. It's not just in 4C. So our data are, to some extent, different from the interpretation other people put on their data. But there's no data set that says that this is wrong. In fact, it's the only data set I know of where people have looked at anything but bandwidth. The people who looked at bandwidth only, so actually, this was an unresolved contradiction in the literature. Hubel and Wiesel and their students tended to say that in monkey, that 4C beta and 4C generally was very poorly, had cells that were very poorly tuned for orientation. And the other layers, you started to get orientation selectivity that was greater. Schiller and Develoy, particularly Schiller was the one who did it with layers, found actually nothing of the kind, that in fact in 4C beta, he found lots of sharply tuned cells, and the bandwidth distributions were identical. And that's sort of roughly what we're saying here with the circular variance, that you do find cells that are very untuned in 4C alpha and beta, but you also find them in 2, 3, and in 6. And the very sharpest tuned cells, you don't find very many of them in 4C, but there are some, and you find very sharply tuned cells in all layers also.
Trained, attuned to a specific, you know, representation?
I'm not sure what the alternative, what this last thing of being tuned to a specific representation is. I'm sorry.
The idea would be that you don't tune the neurons by not in terms of you know, you have a certain set of untuned and tuned cells in any given adult monkey or whatever. Because during learning, cells become more sharply tuned. They sort of.
Well, that's a possibility. Yeah, sure. I mean, we about the mechanisms that how the adult gets to be in the state that we find, we have no information. And it could be easily due to training, but it also could be, could be the training or that every animal undergoes in normal development. But what we're just talking about what are the data? Forgetting about how it comes about. I mean, my work has nothing to say about this whatsoever. And in fact, I would say it's fine with me if you want to say that it's due to memory, but I think that's an open question. Because, and this has to do with other kinds of experiments about which I'm not an expert, having to do with training and altered environments and so on. It could well be that what we're seeing here is due to the sort of normal, quotation marks, training environment that, because the monkeys are very similar one to another. Exactly, that's what I'm saying. But normal training, the normal world that we normally experience, if you don't alter it, you sort of get a monkey that looks like this. But the issue is, what does this mean? Does it mean that, you know, there are only broadly tuned cells here and only narrowly tuned cells here? Well, that's not what we find. So I just wanted to let you know that that's the situation. not knowing and being agnostic, really, as to how it gets that way. But I think that there's, it's part of the, I don't really know quite why things happened the way they did, but there is this general feeling that, you know, things are very specific, that 4C is very specifically broadly tuned in the monkey, that 2-3 is very specifically narrowly tuned in the monkey, and so on. And that isn't really the way it looks in reality, and why people said that, I don't really know.
But wouldn't that be a question of a more precise statistical analysis to find out whether there truly is a tendency for 4C cells to be more broad tuned? I mean, it would make entirely sense because those are the cells that are linked to the thalamus. So you would expect the thalamic cortex.
Well, these are the data. I mean. I'm sorry, these are the data that we have. A more detailed statistical here's the statistical analysis. This is the median of the distribution. These are the first and third quartiles of the distributions. That's the statistical analysis we have. Well, I mean, indeed, one could look at the distributions in detail, not just at the quartiles and so on. Indeed, one could do that. But, you know, that's to recover. And indeed, there may be, I'm not saying that there aren't, statistically significant differences between, say, 4B and 4C if we had 10,000 neurons. I mean, there might be, but it's a different picture than you get if you thought that all of these cells were all the way over there and all of these cells, all of the cells up here were all the way over here. I mean, it's not the same. I mean, I agree with you. I agree with you. You could find differences, and I believe that there are differences between the different layers because of the wiring. I do believe that, but the fact is they're not. What I'm trying to get across is that that a bigger point is that they're not that much different. I mean, they're not as different as you might have thought they would be from just reading books. I'm glad to discuss it more. We have lots of time, so I mean, I'd be glad to discuss it. I don't mind discussing it at all.
Actually, from just reading books, you would get the impression that the cells are fairly the tuning of the cells would be fairly very much the same, sort of, for all.
Well, you're reading different books from the ones I'm reading.
Yeah. Actually, I agree with you. I think that the cells are very different tuned, and they have very different tuning properties. You have cells which are more broad and more wide, as you said. And as I said, it's interesting, on the one hand, that as it pointed out, there is no strict distribution according to layers. So that you find widely and broadly tuned cells in every layer, on the one hand, but on the other hand, you certainly find the statistical distribution, which is characteristic of the different layers. So those are the two facts that we have.
Well, we have them now. I don't think that we had them before now, but I think we do have them in hand now.
I just like it because it's totally predicted by my theory.
Good, that's great. I mean, I'm glad that there's theoretical underpinning for this result, because it's nice to know that that it's not, you know, a result in a vacuum. But I would say, up until recently, that isn't what people thought, and it wasn't. We've met some, you know, mild surprise in discussing these results for people who've just read the standard textbook accounts, I would say. Although it's true that actually, if you look at Shiller's old quantitative data, there was already kind of this kind of idea was there. And one should, but that was never really reconciled with sort of the textbook accounts, as it were. So Mary had a question. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The example where you had four cells that had the same band width assigned with different circular variance measures. And that was because they had risen, there was the variance of the lower level.
Mm-hmm. The pedestal or whatever, that's what we call it. So, also shoulders, Dave McLaughlin likes to call them the shoulders of the tuning curve.
So, so the circular variance is sensitive to the size of the pedestal. Do you have, what does that actually mean in terms of how good the cell is at detecting?
Great. So I made a comment about this, and actually Dario just educated me about this in the last week, so I'll tell you. It's that Sung and Sampolinsky have a information measure for orientation discrimination, which is a ratio of the derivative of the tuning curve by its average value integrated over orientation. And so that measure they derive as a way of predicting discrimination performance in behaviorally. And so it's the Fisher information, right? So that'll, but that actually correlates pretty well, but not perfectly, with the circular variance, because it depends upon the average level of the firing as well as the derivative, which, and the bandwidth, since it's only sensitive to the derivative, is only partly correlated, because it doesn't tell you about the pedestal. So in fact, it is, I mean, it's not perfectly correlated, but it's well correlated with that. The reason it's not perfectly correlated is because you could imagine tuning curves where they're, you know, you could imagine tuning curves that look like this. Where, as a function of theta, it sort of look like that. And then the circular variance would give a different estimate, but that isn't how they usually look. But I mean, you could imagine pathological tuning curves where they wouldn't be so perfect, because the Fisher information is sort of looking really around here, and these things out here that the circular variance is sensitive to would be making a difference. But generally, the curves are not like that, and the two measures covary pretty well. And so what we want to do actually, which we haven't done, is to do a correlation between this Fisher information measure and the circular variance, to just show that they're very closely correlated empirically in the data that we have. But that's something for future work. We haven't done that. But we think that, so what we think is that the kind of thing we're looking at is relatively related to discriminability of orientation. And the reason is because what you want to know is how strong is the response compared to other responses, not just how strong is it compared to just the peak. And that's, Yep.
Are there also multi-modal or bimodal tuning curves?
Say it again?
Tuning curves with two humps.
Yes. I didn't show any of those, but there are, you can see multiple peaks also. And then, of course, the bandwidth is sort of at a loss. It only goes for the biggest peak. So, you know, and there, the circular variance is actually elevated quite a lot because of the other peaks. Okay, let's move on, because I have a lot of other stuff to talk about. Although I have lots of time also, so it's... all right, I'll take that as a comment. Okay, so that's this. And then this is just the bandwidth. Sorry, this I should have shown this before. So this is the bandwidth distribution for the same population of cells. And you see similar sorts of things. There are untuned cells in bandwidth. This is very much like what Shiller found. I'm just going to pass over this. And I just wanted to show you what the low and high circular variance simple cells look like. If you just separate, you just divide the distribution in two using your eye, into the low circular variance and the high circular variance simple cells, and just look at what their tuning curves look like. This is for, this actually gets at this question you asked earlier. This is for the F0 or spike rate measure, and this is for the F1 measure. They look basically the same for low CV cells and high CV cells. And what differentiates them is basically the pedestal. This is getting at the question about discriminability also. So the dashes are, so this is an average tuning curve summing over all of the cells, and these are like standard deviations of, I think, one standard deviation on either side of the average response across the population of cells. And so they're pretty uniform in their properties. Of course, they've all been, you know, all the preferences are different, but they've all been anchored to the, having the same preference. And then you measure the tuning curve around that preferred orientation. And so for the simple cells, what seems to be different about them is whether or not they have a lot of activity away from the peak orientation. So this is just the data. And now I want to take a break. See if I can. Can I make this go to sleep just by going like this? I guess not. Well, it'll go to sleep by itself, as we know. Yes, okay, great. So I want to take a break and talk about orientation mechanisms. Ah, great, thank you. Thank you, Mary. So what I don't have, what I prepared was actually a lecture about our work only, but I didn't actually put in background about everybody else's ideas, which are so different. So now I'm going to take a break and just talk about some of the experiments that you asked about earlier, about orientation selectivity and other people's models. And actually, we could turn on the lights for this. So, so of course you know, everybody knows about the Hubel-Weisel model and how they had the idea that you could explain orientation selectivity of the kind that we've been talking about by just convergence of thalamic input to a neuron. And so they had the idea, you know very well. That, you know, the row of geniculate cells, on cells and off cells, giving the typical kind of picture of a, so the typical cortical cell will have a kernel in space that looks like this. And they say you get it by sort of arranging geniculate cells in a row and smearing them, you know, having maybe multiple ones. And then having, and these things are tokens for things that have sort of a bell-shaped distribution in space, and you can get the kind of thing that you get when you measure it. And then they say this explains the orientation selectivity of the neuron. Now the problem with this is that actually it's very calculable. It's not a problem, but it's a nice thing actually. It's a very implementable model. That is to say, you can take LGN cells whose properties are known, and you can make a model where you sum them up together, and you can predict what will be the orientation selectivity of that group of cells. And so, strikingly, I mean, it's sort of, I think it's amusing anyway. Although this model's been implementable since 1962, the calculations of what actually the predictions are for orientation tuning for this model have only been done in the last 5 years. It's sort of one of these curiosities of history. But anyway, it's been known for a long time, though, that what geniculate cells do, say in the response to the drifting grading patterns that I've been talking about. In response to a drifting grading pattern, a geniculate cell, particularly for the high contrast one that I've been discussing, as a function of time, this is, say, one period of this grading pattern. Usually it's like 250 milliseconds because you're going at 4 hertz modulation. I'm sorry? This is a period of a waveform. This is one period. This is just this is a measure of t. This is 0 to 250 milliseconds. I don't understand the question. I'm just talking about, I'm just plotting time along this axis. Time goes this way. T is infinity, time is here. 250 milliseconds is here. Zero is here. It's a standard time axis.
Yeah, that's why I was asking.
It's a standard way of plotting a single variable. This is minus infinity back here. And zero starts here, and it goes from 0 to 250 milliseconds is there. And all I'm, let me just say that what we're looking at is actually a temporal waveform, which looks like this, looking at one point in space. Time is going this way, and this is the light intensity. Light is a function of time, and it has a mean value. And zero is down here, this is zero light intensity, and time is going this way. And what we're looking at is one period of that waveform, and the response averaged, the spike rate averaged over one period of that waveform. And if we look at that one period, which is not always 250 milliseconds, it's just, you know, that's a standard number that people use. It could be 500, or it could be 100, depending on the preference of the neuron. What you get typically, and this is now spike rate, for an LGN cell, forget about the cortex, you get a response which typically looks like this. This is a histogram, you know. And then it goes down to zero. Because the maintained firing rate, in the absence of stimulation, the maintained firing rate is like that. And then when you drive it with a high contrast pattern, you get it clips because the spike rate can't go below zero. So you get a spike rate distribution that looks like this. Okay?
This is for an LGN cell.
But they're
on and off type,
right? Right, so you have other ones there'll be other ones that for the same pattern, in the same position, they'll look like this. I mean, but they'll also clip. Okay. So each of the inputs to a cortical cell, given that temporal modulation, and you can use these waveforms, which are known, to predict what the response should be to the Hubel-Weisel model. Actually, a couple of different people did that. Chaim Sanfilinski is one of them. Chaim Sanfilinski and his group, and we published that in a review paper that he and I wrote in '97. And then McLaughlin and Shelley and Wheelard and I did that also. Embedded in our paper in the Proceedings of the National Academy last year. And to make a long story short, this model has very little orientation selectivity. And the reason is because if you sum up things that look like that, going this way or that way, the preferred orientation or the anti-preferred orientation, you basically get almost the same total number of spikes. And so if the measure of activity of the cortical cell is total number of spikes, there'll be almost no orientation selectivity for this model. And that's not something that's open to argument. That's just a fact. Okay? Now, you could say, well, I don't want to look at the total number of spikes. I want to look at the modulation. And then you could get substantial differences going this way or this way. And the reason is because it depends upon the spatial frequency that you use in the pattern. If the spatial frequency is fine, so that the sum of all of these cells is, the length scale of that is large compared to the spatial frequency of the pattern, then the response this way will be poor. Whereas suppose, for instance, the spatial scale is like this. This is now space, x. Then this will be a good stimulus going this way, but it'll be a poor stimulus going that way. But on the other hand, the orientation selectivity then will be very spatial frequency dependent, because if you make this spatial scale then very broad, like that, then the orientation tuning will be the same this way and that way. And so it's very, very sensitive to parameters, this model, what the orientation selectivity is that it produces. And in fact, I'll show you some data, if we ever get to it, that in fact the cells are not so so selective. That is to say, they have pretty much the same orientation selectivity for different spatial frequencies. There's some small variation that Ken Miller has made some point of, but basically, they're, relatively speaking, not nearly so sensitive to spatial frequency as the Hubble-Weasel scheme is. Yeah? You had a question?
So the idea is, as far as I understand, is that these populations with binary, somewhat binary, and then the detector would implement something like a high hospital. So insensitive to modulations instead of the average. Is that the idea?
So the wait a second. I don't know which idea you're talking about, but the idea of Hubel and Weasel was just that you added the output of these things.
But now the new thing with the modulation. So how do we get selectivity?
If you are going to be, well, you have to devise some way of doing that. I don't know how. I mean, I'm just saying. Let me backtrack. I think that we're talking across purposes.
Just by asking, what kind of model do you have in mind? When you say there is a model around saying that the modulation should contribute to the tumor?
Actually, it isn't my idea, and it isn't my model, and actually, I'm not responsible for the view, but Förster and Miller have made the point that you could get something like this if there was some way that you could get the neuron to respond to modulation. Now, one could have imagined schemes to do that. You could make the neuron be a very leaky integrate and fire neuron. And it would tend to respond more. So leakage, as Mary and Mike Shelley analyzed this to some extent in our analysis of the reverse time correlation experiments, you could get some selectivity due to leakage because of the neuron's short memory in a leaky integrate and fire neuron. That still doesn't give you very much selectivity, actually, but it gives you some, and more than zero. And in fact, in the calculations that the McLaughlin group did, we included the effects of leakage and still saw very little selectivity. But that's, you do get some.
Does somebody try semantic dispersion as a high pass filter?
I don't think it's been that sophisticated. I mean, as far as I understand it, what Förster has proposed is just, that you can, if there were some way of doing it, you could get selectivity that way. But the thing is that still wouldn't explain about the mean spike rate having no selectivity. That is to say, when you observe cells in the cortex, as I showed you just 5 minutes ago, forgetting about the modulation, the mean spike rate also shows selectivity. And this would not that explanation would not explain that.
This is the mean spike rate, not of the LGN cells, but of the
LGN. Of the cortical cells, yes. If there was some way of doing it, yes, right. Yeah.
No, yeah. But I think you don't need all this complicated. If you imagine cortical cell which has zero maintained rate, but then gen cells have some high maintained rate. So if you go this degrading, the input to a gen to cortical cell would go up and down, but only the up part would be picked up by the cell because it cannot go to negative finite.
This is the threshold explanation of how you get tuning. So the argument, that's a good point. And so the discussion about that is if there's a threshold mechanism for getting selectivity, it can only work for one set of parameters. It's very parameters dependent.
I'm not saying this model is good. I'm just saying that's how.
That's how they made. You're right. That is probably the initial way that they thought about it was that it was just simply a threshold would give you modulation converting into mean spike rate. But that explanation has another problem. It's sort of like there are nested problems, and the nested problem is that explanation can't work for more than one set of parametric conditions, because if you make the response weaker in any way, the response disappears. So, yeah, sorry.
Maybe it's somewhat related. I want to understand better to what extent is the kind of demise of the model is dependent on assuming a specific type of LGN responses. So, the Parvo.
Yes, that's a good point. It's a very good point. So, the Parvo cells would tend to have less of this problem, but they still have it. I mean, so the Magno cells already at like 5% contrast are doing this. And so anything, 10% contrast responses in the cortex would already have this problem. Whereas Parvo cells only begin to start clipping at about 50% contrast. But most of the experiments that have been done, including our own, are done like at 60, 80% contrast. Förster's cat experiments were all done at 75% contrast, where in the cat, basically the cat LGN cells are like magno cells. They saturate and clip at, you know, 10-20% contrast. So this is, so we're, you know, typically the cortical experiments are done in a range where the LGN cells are behaving like this. Although it is true that there are, you know, differences, and you could, there'll be differences depending on magnon parvo.
About the special, so you say basically this model would not be correct in terms of the dependence of the special frequency.
Right.
I was just at the meeting where people made the completely opposite claim. They said that the special frequency dependency is accounted by this model. So if you just assume very simple linear receptivity like this, this becomes. And that just occurred to me, would this be ridiculous if you increase the special frequency by 2? All the sensitivity should disappear, right? Because then you would get two large, two activated, two high dominance lines.
Well, then the response will disappear. Not only the selectivity will disappear, but there'll be no response whatsoever. Well, I mean, response, you can go to a higher spatial frequency where there's no response. I'll show you data about that.
But is it true that if you increase it by 2 relative to the optimal frequency, the response? Is there a direct prediction of this?
I think that the answer to that is probably yes. I have to look, we could look at the data and see it together. But I mean, I haven't looked at it that way, but I think you're right. This issue about spatial frequency, let's go back to when we see some data, okay? But let me just say that independent, so this analysis of the what the Hubbell-Weigel model would do came after the recent flurry of experiments that have been trying to find evidence in favor of this sort of model. So I just wanted to go over, since you probably are familiar with all of these different experiments, I wanted to discuss them as a background to the new experiments that we're doing, because I think that you should at least know where I'm coming from. Anyway, I mean, why I'm pursuing this in the face of what seem to be experiments that are supposed to be convincing people that there's no problem. But I think that there is a problem and the experiments are not convincing. But let me say why. So there are three experiments. Let me go back to that. Yes. So let me get them in the correct chronological order. There's one experiment that's the ferret experiment. By Chapman and Stryker. And many of you aficionados will know what I'm talking about, but I'll go over it. And then there's the cat experiment by Reed and Alonzo. And then there's the cat experiment by Förster et al. This is the cooling experiment. This is the cross-correlation experiment. And this is the Musimol experiment. Okay? All right? So what these guys did here was they, recording in the ferret, they spritzed Musimol in the input layer, corresponding to what's 4C in the monkey, it's layer 4 in the ferret, and they silenced all of the cortical activity. Musimol is a GABA agonist, which acts as an inhibitory transmitter in the cortex. And so it sort of basically inhibited all the cortical activity, but didn't inhibit LGN terminal activity that they could pick up in the region. And what they found is little rows of LGN cells in a row. Just like the Hubbell-Weigel model said, in ferret layer 4. Okay, so this is the Musimol experiment. Now, actually, I'm drawing it better than the data look, but let's just give them the benefit of the doubt that it shows what they claimed it showed. They found a row. These are LGN terminals lined up in layer 4 of the ferret. They found a row of LGN terminals with receptive fields of this shape near each other when they were recording from one location in layer 4 of the ferret, where it was silenced with a spritz of Musimol. So the cortical activity is all dead, and all they're seeing is the LGN terminals. By hypothesis. Well, they're using visual stimulation to drive the LGN cells, right?
How do they know where they discovered from which LGN cell?
Well, they find just three different discrete regions that are driving activity that they're picking up with one electrode.
Okay. Short, small
stimulus. Yeah, right.
But you claim that this explains all of your thinking, just to want to show that there is some...
Well, that's the whole issue. That's the whole issue. Because, in fact, later, the same group... This was Chapman, Zaz, and Stryker. Sorry. And then later, Chapman and Stryker alone actually measured the orientation selectivity of neurons in this layer. And do you know what the answer was? They had almost no orientation selectivity whatsoever. They had circular variances like 0.9. So there are two conclusions from those two results. One is, we already know that actually a row of these cells combined together in a Hubel-Weasel-like combination don't generate very much orientation selectivity. That's one conclusion from their experiment, is that it is true that they have this kind of input, but the cells are non-selective. That's the first conclusion. Or the second conclusion is that actually this is an epiphenomenon, and actually the neurons are not connected to all of the cells. It just, you know, it just happens that there seem to be alignments which happen at random, and it's statistics of small numbers. Either one of those, I think, is plausible, because in fact, the data don't always look as clean as this. They have things that are, you know, a full statistical analysis was never completed on these data. But in any case, the fact that the ferret layer 4, it's layer 4, that those neurons have almost no orientation selectivity at all, suggests that this is not evidence in favor of such an arrangement causing orientation selectivity. So this experiment that is taken as evidence that this kind of row of input can cause orientation selectivity is not really evidence for that point. So I broke the chalk. That's terrible.
What was the rationale for doing
it in the ferret? They have very clear layers. I guess that's part of it. Unlike the cat, it's the lamination is clear as it is in the monkey, and they're a lot cheaper than monkeys. So this experiment actually doesn't prove at all that the collinear arrangement of LGN cells will give orientation selectivity, since the neurons don't have orientation selectivity. Yeah.
So you get it right that you think in the parent layer 4, cells are less tuned than typically in monkeys?
In layer 4C of the monkey, that's right, yeah.
Uh-huh.
That's right. I mean, I know it's contrary to what we've been taught, but that's what... They did a very nice study, actually. I mean, this Chapman and Stryker study, which is embedded in a paper about development, so they don't really highlight it as a separate study, but it's there. They do a very nice quantitative analysis of using a measure which is basically 1 minus circular variance. So it's the same measure that we use. And they show that it's distributed, but that it has a mean that's very high, or low for that measure, but high for our measure, and low selectivity. So they did it's basically like our study, except that they get this result, which is, it's very comparable in terms of the kind of things that they did. But the results are different. The ferret's layer 4 is very shifted compared to the other layers.
So in comparison to your distributions from whatever layer, their distribution is narrow and at the low tuning.
That's correct, it is. Mm-hmm. I mean, judging from what they published. I mean, we haven't done those experiments, but that's... So it's a nice quantitative study, but the bottom line is it doesn't prove anything about a row of LGN cells causing selectivity. So then there's the cat experiment by Reed and Alonzo, the cross-correlation experiment, where they measured a cortical cell's receptive field, and they plotted it using advanced techniques of visual stimulation. And then they measured simultaneously from an LGN cell that was monosynaptically connected to this cortical cell, and they found that the LGN field sort of was always lining up with a cortical cell subregion that was of the proper sign. But then, after they did all of these experiments, each one of which looked like this, that is to say, there was one LGN cell and one cortical cell, and they did maybe 100 of those. Then afterwards, they plotted all the LGN cells within the receptive field where they found them, and they said, ah, this confirms the Hubel-Weasel model. But they never, ever measured several LGN cells converging on one cortical cell, contrary to what the picture might make you think. So that my feeling about this is that indeed it shows that indeed the LGN cells' wiring is consistent. It isn't anti-correlated with the cortical cells driving, but that this input up here could or could not come from other LGN cells or could be coming from cortical cells. It's just not known. In any case, as I said before, even if it were connected in a row, that wouldn't necessarily give it any tuning. So I mean, so this experiment also, I would say, my interpretation of this experiment is that it doesn't prove anything about the Hubel-Weasel model, although it is a very nice demonstration about the correlation between the LGN and the cortical cells' responses. Yeah, sure. Sure, absolutely. We should talk about these things because I want to discuss them so our differences are aired.
There's not a single cortical cell in the Alonzo Reed data set that has been shown to be connected to two LGN cells.
No, because it's such a hard thing to do. I mean, yeah.
But they tried to find several cells.
I'm sure they tried to do it, but I think it's just impossible.
But yeah. You probably still believe that there are other cells. You don't believe that the cortical cell has just one driving sort of.
It's true. I mean, I think that it's likely that there are multiple cortical LGN inputs, although I think that it's possible that in many cells there's only one or two, plus one on, one off. I mean, I think there's a whole distribution. My theme for today is distributions. I think that there's a distribution of this and a distribution of that. And so one distribution is, five and the other is 20 and the other is two. And,
these are the numbers, not 500.
Right. It's an order of magnitude of 10. 10 to 20, something like that is the most. And I think it goes down to one. I think it's from these cross-correlation experiments and, that you get an upper bound in the numbers because there's some, drive 10% of the spikes.
So you say many times you record from the cells and they have right location of the fields and they're not correlated.
Yeah. Also, there's other difficulties with the interpretation of this experiment because the LGN cells are correlated. So sometimes when you get it might not be the one that's driving it. It might be its neighbor who he's correlated with who's driving it. It's complicated. I mean, it's not really proof. The cross-correlation experiment isn't really proof that the two are connected, really. You really need to actually drive one and see that it... And cut. You need to kill that cell and see that the cell doesn't get driven, and that they couldn't
there
do.
There is some other cell in the vicinity which is connected.
Right, yeah, that's right.
Yeah,
it's true. I mean, it's right, but it's just there are difficulties. Yeah. There may be five cells that are correlated, and they're all giving synchronous input. Yeah, you had another question.
Yeah, I think I once worked my way through a Jones paper, which estimated that on the order of hundreds to a few hundred synapses on a layer 4.
Jones.
Cell. From LGN.
Yeah, no, Kevin Martin had very large estimates of the numbers also from anatomy. It's just the physiologists tend to come up with very small numbers. It might be there are a lot of silent synapses or something.
If these numbers are right, then many of these synapses come from the same LGN neuron?
Could be. That could be. I mean, I understand that there are these differences. It's just the physiologists are pretty consistent in giving fairly small numbers. Mm-hmm. So I agree with you. Martin and his group, I have a much larger estimate. I don't know the reason why. I can't explain that. Okay, so the last experiment is the cortical cooling experiment, the first et al. And so what they did, you probably know the logic, is that they cooled the cortex with a cooling probe, recording from a cell intracellularly the whole time. It was, a tremendously heroic experiment. The response, the idea was that the cortical synapses would be sensitive to cooling, but that the LGN synapse would be less sensitive to cooling, so that the cortical-cortical couplings would all be, all the cortical cells' responses would go to zero. There'd be no cortical-cortical interaction, but the LGN synapses would be visible, measured intracellularly. And so the spikes from the LGN cells would cause synaptic release. It would be diminished because of the lower temperature, but you could still see its pattern and get an idea of whether it was tuned. And what they found was that if you looked at the response to a drifting grating pattern and measured the modulation of the response, that it was tuned as much in the cooled cortex as it was in the warm cortex. And they inferred from that that the LGN cells, the tuning of the selectivity of the neurons was conferred upon the cell by its LGN input. Now, as I said before, when we analyze this, even granting all of these suppositions, we predict that the cortical cells wouldn't be tuned with this kind of input. One thing that was done in these experiments, it was really just like the Hubel-Weisel plan, is that they used a grading which was the optimal spatial frequency. So if this is the row, this is the hypothesized row, it's as I drew it before. They used a spatial frequency which was just like that. And in fact, as I said before, for the Hubel-Weisel model, for Foerster's array, the only reason why there's any selectivity at all is that the spatial frequency is chosen so that this direction responds and this direction doesn't. So it's completely dependent on the parameters of the experiment. And as I told David afterwards, it would have been much better for this experiment if you just used a drifting bar, because then you could have seen whether, you know, if it was really a Hubel-Weisel model, there should have been no direction, there should have been no orientation selectivity, even in the cooled cortex. But because what you'd get in, as a function of time for a drifting bar, in the warm cortex it would sort of look like that, and in the cooled cortex, in the warm cortex it would look like this in the preferred orientation, and like this in the anti-preferred orientation. This would be preferred, and this would be 90 to preferred. This is if you'd use the bar, because again, this is what the Hubel-Weisel model would predict. It would predict a response which was not as high, but broader, if you go this way as opposed to this way. But he didn't do that. He used a drifting grading pattern. He got selectivity. In a sense, his experiment is, I would say, transparent to the issue, because the thing is, even if everything he says is true, it's still not going to be the case that this model will explain the orientation selectivity that we observe in the cells. So in a sense, this experiment is not really irrelevant. It just sort of doesn't tell us anything. It's neutral. Yeah.
This
difference in width of this response. Yeah, that's sort of like the aspect ratio of, that's the only reason, yeah. But they didn't do that. They didn't do that experiment. They only used drifting gradings. I mean, if they had done that, it would have been, you know, and they had found this result, it would have proven that they were looking at the LGN input only. As it is, there's a lot of, you know, skepticism about whether they were looking at the LGN input only. But even if they were, you know, it's sort of like, no matter what he would have done, it wouldn't have satisfied me. But because basically, if he proves that it's the Hubel-Weisel model, it's not going to account for orientation selectivity. But it would have been nice if he had done this experiment instead of the drifting grading experiment, because it would have been at least to know that it was LGN input or not. As it is, you don't know if it was really LGN input.
Why was not this experiment was not repeated?
It's so hard; no one wants to do it.
Okay.
It's really just disgustingly hard. Yes, I mean, to do intracellular recording is already hard. To do it with a cooling probe on is, you know, you lose half the cells. It takes forever. They spent a year doing 10 cells. It was just horrible. You know, one cell per monkey, per cat. And so it's like, you know, they did maybe 20 weeks worth of work that was backbreaking to get the result. So it's a hard experiment.
But it seems to be important.
I guess I would say it's not important. I mean, basically, what I would say is, suppose it turns out that, in fact, when you cool the cortex, the input to the cell is a bunch of LGN cells that are arranged in a row. It's still not going to explain orientation selectivity.
What about Kamila's push-pull model?
Well, Kamila's push-pull model is another story altogether, but that can't be explored with the cooling experiment, because the cooling experiment removes all cortical inhibition.
Yeah, but he uses feed-forward. Yeah,
but it's still going through the cortical cell, so indeed, there will be no... Let's talk about Ken Miller's model in a second, okay? You had a question. I'll go back to that.
Okay. There's a study of Volkers, I don't know whether you're aware of that, that tried to at least find out what cooling does to cortical circuit. And as far as I recall, he found that in a certain temperature range, the cells are not shut down, they become hyper.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is that an issue?
I mean, the thing is, so this is the issue of whether in Foerster's experiment he really was silencing the cortex. What I'm saying is, let's give it to him that he silenced the cortex. It's still not going to explain, you know, anything about orientation selectivity, because if it were only the LGN input and no cortical interaction, there's no way that it could account for selectivity. I mean, because we can calculate what it should do in it. And so then we should, you know, if his experiment is really believable as LGN input, then we can predict what the outcome should be, and it should be no selectivity. That's the answer. Now, let me get back to Ken Miller for a second. Ken Miller is a whole different kettle of fish, because Ken Miller is assuming that the cortex is all working, and that there are inhibitory interneurons, which are cortical neurons, which are firing spikes, which are causing synaptic potentials in other cortical neurons. So in the Foerster experiment, that whole machinery is removed. There's no Ken Miller in the cooled cortex, okay? Just to be clear about that, all right? Okay? And so indeed, that whole explanation is irrelevant to understanding Foerster's experiment. You may be confused about that, because Foerster and Miller are friends, and they say they agree, and that feed-forward excitation can explain orientation selectivity, but it's not true that Miller's theory is related to Foerster's experiment. It's completely disjoint. Is that clear? I mean, if you don't agree, we should discuss it, but to me, it's completely clear that Miller's theory is for the warm cortex.
I agree, but it looks like Miller's model depends very less on cortex cells.
Well, I think that's a very clear result of Miller's way of presenting his material. It depends a lot on what the cortical cells are like.
Yeah, but not for sharpening.
It does depend very much on what the cortical cells are like for sharpening. Because, this is a theoretical talk. I was trying to talk about data, but let me just say, let's talk about this later. I'll just say the following, that Miller's method for getting sharpening of orientation selectivity is the same method, really, as Sampolinsky's method, and it's the same method as Summers' method. It's really inhibition that is broadband in orientation, subtracted from excitation, which is also broadband in orientation. And what you do by taking the differences of these two broad things, you get a sharper thing. And however he tries to sell it, that's really what's going on. Okay? And I think that, you know, so Ken Miller will be here later. Maybe he'll try to sell it to you again in terms of, you know, his phase sensitive this and his phase sensitive that. The machinery that's really working in that model is very broadly tuned inhibition, subtracting from broadly tuned excitation, giving you sort of a Mexican hat in orientation. That's the real machinery that's working. And it depends on the cortex being active. So Foerster's experiment is completely orthogonal to Miller's theory. They're not even related.
So should we believe that LGN inputs are arranged in this prolongated group?
To me, I mean, so what I would say is that it's still an open question. But in a sense, it's irrelevant.
No, it's
an open question, and my feeling is that you do need some kind of arrangement in order to get a preference map. So there has to be something that breaks the complete randomness of this situation in order to get some kind of orderly mapping. So I believe that there's going to be some correlated input. But it might just be two, or it might just be, you know, you can get preference just with this kind of pair, where if they also have inhibition. So you don't need an elongated row, as long as they're sort of in an orderly, you know, way. If it's orderly so that, you know, you have this pair, and then you also have this pair, and then you also have, you know, obliques, you can sort of get an orderly map with just two. But I think it's open. I mean, I really think it's an issue that is open. But what I'm trying to get at is that's important for preference. But it's sort of irrelevant for selectivity, because selectivity has to be generated some other way, in a way that our data indicate. Okay? I think there's been a lot of confusion about this in the literature, in fact.
It's still an issue if you really need some, because, you know, we have a classical model where the question is whether this should be ruled out, or it could still happen.
Well, the thing is, I think that the data don't really speak to it. I mean, so far, I think that they don't really address the issue, because they don't really get at the nub of the issue, which is there an orderly array of preferences in the absence of cortical-cortical interaction? And that's really that's the nub of the issue, and that's not been addressed. In my view, I mean, you have different views, but that's my view of what's going on.
What about Volkoshek's intracellular study, where he independently measures orientation selectivity and tries to figure out the runoff zones? And he comes to your conclusions, essentially, that there is some degree of alignment of these runoff subzones, but that they are insufficient to explain the complete orientation selectivity of the cells.
Yeah.
So there you have four things in the same cell measured intercellularly.
Well, I mean, I think it's great stuff. I mean, it's wonderful and also heroic. Let me just show you some. I'm sorry. I mean, intracellular. Anybody who does intracellular recording in the cortex is a hero in my book. It's very hard.
So, but since we're already in the sociology of this,
we are.
There's this absolutely convincing study that orientation activity depends on cortical interaction by the Ivy group. How can anybody ignore these results?
Well, I don't. I don't explain that. I mean, there are many things I can't explain about sociology. I'm just still working on physiology. Can we turn the projector, open the projector up again? I just want to show you something. What, did you turn it off? Yeah, right. What happened to it?
Pressing the power.
Don't.
Now, if you press it the second time, it would suffer.
So anyway, so what I wanted to do is go on to actually now, after the break, run through what we did to try to get it at what could give orientation selectivity, as opposed to what doesn't give orientation selectivity. So these are experiments that are started in New York and continued both in New York and in California with Dario Ringach, who's now a professor at UCLA. This is the basic scheme. So this is the physiology down here. This is the one bit of physiology. Everything else is stimulus and analysis. So this is my part. I get a cell in V1, and it has a spike train. And on the computer, that the screen that the animal is looking at, a movie is generated. These are stills from the movie. It's a very experimental movie. So it's like a New York, you know, bohemian cinema, where it's just gratings of different orientations chosen randomly. The orientation is chosen randomly with time. So it's like a very experimental movie. No soundtrack, just that. It changes every frame a new orientation is chosen. So it changes abruptly at each orientation. At each frame. The frames are very rapid. So they're in the initial data set, they were 60 frames a second at video rates. And later, actually, we've been working at 100 frames a second, but changing the picture every second frame, so at 50 pictures a second.
So if you're looking, you can see a blur.
What you see is something that looks like a noise. It looks like a visual noise. If you run your hands or you blink or something, you'll see a grating for an instant, and then a new grating comes up. And actually, the duration of the pictures is a parameter that you can set, but all of our experiments so far have been done with high-speed pictures to try to get high resolution of the temporal processing of orientation. But you could change that and look at different time frames.
So you're saying for most of the grating doesn't have the time to move?
It never moves. It just flashed.
Flashed.
These are flashed gratings. They're not moving. So we've changed paradigm completely into stationary but flashed gratings. Now, what happens is that there are all orientations in the movie, and also for each grating, four different spatial positions or phases to exhaustively cover all different possibilities. And then we average over the phases.
Just four.
Right, you know, peak, 90 degrees, and so on.
You present that on a TV screen?
Yes.
But if you present it for only, say, 20 minutes, so you just
adopt
for some
time? No.
Full picture in-
Absolutely, that's how your television works. So this is how your screen works sorry, it's not 20 milliseconds. If I said that, I was wrong. I may have misspoken. There are 100 frames a second, and for two frames the picture is presented, right? So you're right, it's 20 milliseconds each picture. That's right. And then another picture and so on. Well, you know, if you're looking at your 75 hertz video monitor, that's what's happening also.
If I would look in this 10 milliseconds, the picture
Yeah, well, you're seeing a frame being created by a high-speed raster, which is going at like 100 kilohertz. It's painting so that the whole frame is visible within, 10 milliseconds. That's how a 100 hertz monitor works.
This doesn't come up, but it's the bank.
This is on. Sorry. Every single word is being listened to upstairs. I can know. Upstairs, that's right. Right, in heaven, right, exactly. This is a messenger from way upstairs. I'm sorry, I'm trying to get your question. I'm not clear.
I'm not sure if the techniques really produce what you want.
Absolutely it does.
One single frame, build up on the TV from one side.
Yeah, of course. That's how it always works on a CRT.
If you present on one frame, you have always something like whoop.
Yeah, but the whoop, okay. The whoop is on a time scale that's fast compared to the temporal integration in the retina. So essentially, it's painted instantaneously as far as the retina is concerned. That is to say, all those photons, and if you're in a different position, those are sort of within the integration time of a retinal receptor. So the differences between the top and the bottom of the frame are irrelevant from the point of view of these cells, and that's not irrelevant.
These effects don't cover all of the screen, right?
Well, that's true too, but the whole, sometimes you use big patches which are half of the screen, but it's still true that from our point of view, we're using TV rasters the way we've always used them, and everything behaves as if what's going on prior to the cortex, or prior to the retinal ganglion cell anyway, is a linear filtering of the raster into a light distribution, which is uniform. I mean, I wouldn't worry about that part. That's the least of the things to worry about. Okay, so anyway, these things are streaming by, and the cells fire. Now, one of the reasons why I need to use this technique, so this is the technique which is often called a reverse correlation technique, but it's not all reverse correlation techniques are equivalent, and this is reverse correlation with basically continuous TV raster presentation. And one thing that's nice about this technique is that the cortical cells as a group get all activated, so that most of the cells are above threshold. Some 5 spikes a second, some 10 spikes a second, but very few of them are at zero. And theoretically, what it means is that more or less the cortex is in a defined, activated state. So that's nice because it allows you to sort of see interactions that might be invisible if some of the cells were below threshold and some of the cells were above threshold.
But the special frequency here is not adjusted to the...
Actually, it is adjusted. But in fact, it isn't that sensitive. You'll see. The cells are fairly broadly tuned for special frequency. But indeed, it is an optimal spatial frequency. The circles are chosen to roughly fill the receptive field of the neuron and be a little bit bigger. What that means is that they'll probably cover several hypercolumns in terms of mapping it onto the cortex, and say order of magnitude 5. And so lots of neurons are being activated. We've looked a little bit at size and things. There are effects of size. I mean, we could talk about that, but that's not first order. And so what happens is that there's a spike train being created. And typically we run these things for on the order of magnitude of 15 minutes to a half an hour, depending on the situation. So we get thousands of spikes, 5,000 to 10,000 spikes. So we get very smooth functions this way, very smooth correlations. And we're using orientations that go around the clock uniformly. And usually they're in 20 degree steps, sometimes in 10 degree steps. Usually they're in 10 degree steps, sometimes in 5 degree steps. I'm sorry, I misspoke. So there are 72, I think, different stimuli. 4 phases, 18 orientations. And then you pick from that set. And they're all, you can set the contrast in most of these experiments I'm talking about. It's high contrast, trying to get the biggest response. Okay? Now, what's happening, now to get to the meat of it, so you have this spike train, and for every spike, what you can do is correlate it with what drove it. So you say, what is the pattern that occurred at a fixed time offset before the spike occurred. And so in this case, it's this pattern for this spike. So you increment a bin which corresponds to this orientation, which here he says is this. But anyway, whatever orientation this is, you increment the bin. And then over time, over all the spikes, you do that for every spike. So you build up a histogram, which describes what was the probability of getting what was the probability that a spike was elicited by this pattern. And you can get a tuning curve. Now that's for a given time offset. And what you can do is you can do this for all different time offsets. So you can actually study this as a function of time. And therefore, you get out a response movie which corresponds to the stimulus movie. The response movie is the orientation selectivity as a function of time. Okay? Correct. And actually, it's flat even at positive time if it's too short. So if time is up to about 30 to 40 to 50 milliseconds, it's also flat. And if you wait beyond 200 milliseconds, it gets flat again. And in between is when it's interesting. So I'll show you some interesting ones. So this is actually a figure from our 97 Nature paper, which shows all the different kinds of patterns that we saw for these orientation selectivities as a function of time in V1 of monkey. And you see 4C alpha and 4C beta. See, now you're experts on the layers, so you know that there are laminar differences, and 4B, and here's another 4B cell, and here's 2, 3, and 5, and 2, 3, and a layer 6 cell. So they're all different kinds of funny different features, and I'll just draw attention to some of them. In the 4C alpha and 4C beta cells, what we noticed is that fairly broad featureless tuning using this technique. But I'll amend that with some later data. In 4B, we see actually the beginning of things that we didn't see in 4C alpha and beta using that old technique, which was, this is, you know, version 1.0. Version 1.1 was better. But version 1.0 just showed that 4B was very different from 4C beta. You see more sharp tuning, but also later in time, actually the tuning curve no longer has the same shape. It actually changes shape with time. And in fact, you get more evidence for suppression or dips in the tuning curve later. And sometimes actually the tuning curve just flips over and changes to the opposite polarity. So that the best orientation here early becomes the worst orientation later.
This orientation is relative to the angle of the appendages, or it's an absolute?
This is absolute. So this is orientation on the screen in the world.
So you're getting all these random.
Well, these are all the different orientations, and then we plot out the tuning curve afterwards.
This is
one cell, this is one cell, this is one cell, this is one cell. These are different cells. So this is orientation in the world. And okay. And then in the 2-3 cells, you actually see some cases where you can sort of see a shift in the peak. You can sort of see it shifting to the right, so it comes over on the other side. And you see that. So in some layer 2, 3, and 5 cells, you can see this shifting going on. There's actually changes in preference with time. And you can see in both the 4B cell and also in some of the 2, 3 cells, at intermediate times, some kind of Mexican hat organization where, you know, there's actually some orientations are producing responses above the baseline and other orientations are producing responses below the baseline. It's true, but as an advanced theoretician like you can easily calculate, cross-correlation is symmetric in its arguments, and so if you correlate with the spikes to the stimulus, you can actually correlate from the stimulus to the spikes. It's a completely symmetric computation. So the correlation we're calculating, sometimes confused, is that it is a reverse correlation, but it actually is the cross-correlation between the stimulus and the output, and therefore you can look at it either way. That is, you change the variable from t minus tau to tau, and the other one becomes t minus tau, and then you get the cross-correlation. So in fact, I'm sorry, t plus tau. And then, but you can just do a substitution of variables, and it becomes the other variable. And so indeed, they are the same thing. So it's a convenience of measuring to use the reverse correlation, but it's just the cross-correlation you're measuring.
And you didn't look at the high order stuff?
We did not. And that's a very fertile ground, but it's, we've been looking at other things instead. But indeed, that's something that, you know, there are a lot of data that could be looked at in terms of second and higher order correlations. So this is all a first order analysis. That's a good point. This is basically looking at the best stimulus for a neuron, averaging over all kinds of context, of previous sequences and so on. This is the best first order correlation. So you see all kinds of things. I mean, and it does seem to be related to where the cells are living and so on and so forth. So one thing, let me just say, one thing that we should comment on, though, is that even with these data here, we can say that the orientation selectivity is a dynamical output variable. That is to say, although we measure average orientation selectivity with these steady-state measurements, in fact, it's something which varies with time, depending on after the stimulus. There's has like an impulse response in time. And so understanding the actual mechanisms for selectivity, we think, should be studied sort of at this level of analysis, trying to understand the dynamics of it. Sure. Please, at all times you can ask questions.
What's this cell H in your previous?
Cell H. Right. Yeah, that's a, so you see this in layer 6 cells.
But,
well, we don't see this very often, but you can occasionally see this in the deeper layers, that you see double peaks. It's true. It's very interesting. I agree. I mean, there's lots of things I didn't go over in this slide, but I mean, that's one of them. That you see changes in selectivity with time, and actually, and it kind of reverses. And
your feeling is that in layer 6 or in lower layers, this is the place where you can possibly run through such a cell, but probably not in upper.
So far, I mean, we don't have a full catalog, I have to say, of this feature. Mm-hmm. But I have seen it in other layer 6 cells. Yeah, these are the mean rates. That's right.
So it's a very low rate.
That's right. You get that. I mean, you sort of get all different rates. I'm sorry? Right. Yes, but he's talking about this sort of frank double peak. So here, I mean, it's sort of, you could just think of this as double peaking. It's true. Or here. We're going to have a more sophisticated analysis later. I mean, this was the first pass. Yeah?
So this is not the same as if you have just one grading, right? Because we're thinking you have other interfering grading.
That's right.
So it's not the same as if you just show one grading, the dynamics will not show the same thing, right?
Well, we don't know. I mean, I think the answer is that that's a complicated experiment. I agree with you. I agree with you. You're right. You're right. This is not the same situation,
yes,
as a single grading presentation, and it's, you're absolutely right. I mean, to make we could unbundle that, but the short answer is correct, and so therefore, one shouldn't necessarily compare these things except at a mechanistic level. Yeah. Another question? Okay. Let's go on, because there's a lot of stuff to see. You'll see there are more interesting things later. So I just want to show you, so a way of looking at this is to look at the circular variance of each of these tuning curves and plot that as a function of time. So we can actually see the time dependence of the orientation selectivity exhibited with a single parameter. Okay? And what you see is that it starts at, the tuning curves are flat, so the circular variance is high. Then it drops to its minimum value. That's the peak of the orientation selectivity. That's the greatest orientation selectivity. And then it goes back up. Often there's a secondary peak, which is associated with some of those suppressive effects. And then a final relaxation back to its steady level. Here it's relaxing rather rapidly. Now, the position of this minimum is actually an important number, because that actually says, how long does it take for the cells to produce their maximal orientation selectivity? Where the greatest selectivity. No, it isn't necessarily. I mean, it could be, and it often is near, But it doesn't have to be. These are, this is two different measures. And in fact, one thing that we need to do is to compare the two. We haven't done that. I mean, it's near the maximum response. I mean, maximum responses are in this vicinity, but exactly how closely they correlate is not clear. And I'll show you some data about that that's very important later. So this, for instance, this region in here, there may actually be responses occurring here, but there's no selectivity change. And that's an important issue, especially for layer 4C. So, I mean, it's a crucial issue, actually. One comment is that the LGN input, the peak LGN input, the peak of the impulse response for the LGN is around here. So the selectivity is occurring late compared to the LGN arrival.
But you could have a membrane time constant, right? That means it should drive the membrane time constant.
You're absolutely right. But the membrane, we can estimate, we estimate the membrane time constant from our own and other experiments to be rather short, on the range of under 5 milliseconds.
So what generates the delay in the response?
We don't know. I mean, we have theoretical ideas, but we don't have a complete explanation. We think it's to do with the synaptic time scales in the cortex. But in fact, there isn't a complete account. I'll show you some data about this in a second.
So the 5 millisecond is a primitive cell we're talking about?
It's, we think that it's characteristic of all the cells, that their time constants are actually rather short.
But normally you would think that inhibitor cells are faster spike.
Well, the inhibitory cells may have even shorter time constants. But, so the excitatory cells...
They seem to be very fast.
Well, it seems to be very fast, but actually if you consider the data that are in the literature, it's completely in the ballpark. And if you want, I have another whole talk about that. But basically, if you look at the, what's known about the background firing rates and background effect of background on time constant, and then if you look at what's known about the increase in conductance during visual stimulation, the estimate of 5 milliseconds is maybe an overestimate. And it's very conservative. It's just what other people say. If you just follow what their reasoning is, you get, it's about a factor of three speed up due to just background activity compared to the slice, and there's another factor of three due to stimulation, and you get about a factor of 10, and that's, you're in the 2 to 3 millisecond range. So five is like a sort of conservative upper estimate. So there, so this delay compared to the LGN input is not due to the membrane time constant of the cells. Yeah?
Just to bring up the full glory of this beautiful graph, it's exactly the opposite of a very old finding by Simon Thurlow.
Yes.
Much less than a finding.
Yes.
From the first five, you have the full change.
Yes. So this actually is an answer to Thorpe. And the reason that we think that Thorpe got the result that he got, and he continues to believe, you know, that the first spike, and he's not the only one. I mean, other people in our own department, Peter Lenny and his group, have found similar observations. I think it's correct that if you look at sort of the a randomly selected cortical cell, and you look at the response to a step, and you look at the first spike, it'll be selective. I think that is correct. But I think that that's completely consistent with these results. That is to say, I don't think that the two things are in conflict. Because in those experiments, you have a high threshold situation. Typically, you're coming out of, you can't really see the membrane potential. And so the spike rate and the membrane potential in that situation are not closely following each other, whereas in this case, they are. And that's, I could expand on that later, but let me go on. So, so I think that, and I'll show you other examples of this, that it's even more dramatic than in this example, that the selectivity evolves with time. Here is an undigested bit of news, which is if you look at all the cells, and this is now the time to peak, so the minimum, the time at which you get the minimum circular variance. And there are cells form into groups, which are, in this experiment, there are these cells that have fairly low circular variance and those that have fairly high circular variance. And the low circular variance cells tend to have times to peak that are sort of in the range of 60 milliseconds, plus or minus. This is the peak circular variance.
The peak, the minimum.
The minimum. So if we, it's this circular variance here. Okay. And it's just interesting that you find faster cells among the higher circular variance cells, and that this group tends to be fairly consistent at sort of in the 60 millisecond range, and the allergen input is sort of coming in around there in this range. So a lot of these cells are delayed with respect to the allergen input having a peak sensitivity. So this is just a fact. I don't really explain it. It's just a...
So I don't understand. What do you mean? If you have a cell in the circular virus close to one,
yeah,
it basically never goes down, but it
doesn't go down much, right?
Or you just pick up random time, basically.
Well, it's never really at one. So it's not at one. These are sort of ones, you know, in the 0.9 range. Wherever it has its local, you know. Yeah, and you take wherever it is. Yeah. It could be. So these ones up here you could ignore. But everything below it you could pay attention to.
Yeah, the question is, what do you really have to ignore and what not? Because, of course, if you have a very deep minimal, you can estimate its timing very precisely. But if you have just very shallow minimal, of course, its timing is not very precise.
Yeah, but there's no difference between here and there. I mean, these are about the same distribution as these. And certainly these have, you know, if you're down to 0.5, you can certainly judge where the minimum is. I don't think it's an issue.
So you believe most of these points?
Yeah, I mean, I mean, it's not a big deal. It's just that they tend to, that the narrowly tuned ones, the highly selective ones, tend to be a little slow. Slower than the fastest input. Sorry? Yes, well, that's another possibility. It just takes long. There's like a slewing rate. But whatever it is, you get to it, it takes longer to get to it. You don't get to it instantaneously. So that needs to be understood theoretically. And this is just a lot of data, just to show you. So this is now showing you from this slide, from two slides ago, the X's are the beginning point. Let's go back, sorry. So I'm going to show you is distributions of the latency, the peak, and the tail over the whole data set that we had up to that point. And this is the X's are the latency, the open circles are the peaks, and the filled circles are the tails. And the point is just to show that there's, again, a mess. There's a lot of distribution. But that some of the fastest ones are actually occurring in the input layers. The LGN input has to be coming in, you know, in this range. And that there are the times to peak are actually, in some cases, quite delayed with respect to that input. So that something is happening in time, going between the input layers and the output layers. And some of the peaks in the, for instance, the peaks up here in upper layer 2-3, and some of these cells down in 6 and 5, are peaking at the time when cells in 4C generally are having their tail and dying away. So there's kind of some kind of persistence of signals within the cortex. And then, what I wanted to show you here is some more recent data. This is like version 1.1 of a 4C alpha neuron. And this is studied with a technique like I showed you, of reverse correlation with the grating stimuli. But now there's an additional stimulus added, which is a blank, a uniform screen, every 18 stimuli, a blank is added. Not every 18 stimuli, but I mean at random. But you know, with a percentage of 1 out of 18, so it's like another orientation, a blank is added. And then you correlate with the blank, and the correlation with the blank is indicated by the dashed line. So what this gives you is a kind of baseline. It's sort of like how many spikes are elicited by uniform field. That's always going to be roughly constant. And so the question is, then how are the gratings, how are they at eliciting spikes compared to this baseline? And what you see is very early in the response, there's a uniform or almost uniform elevation of the probability of eliciting a spike above the blank probability. And then later, this uniform distribution becomes more peaked. And even later, you can actually see some dips below the blank. And then actually later, again, there's a very broad uniform distribution, which then subsides away to zero. So neglecting what's going on after 70 milliseconds, just for the sake of argument, I think that this sequence is very important. This is, again, remember, this is from an input layer neuron. And we have several input layer neurons that we've examined like this. It looks as though in many of these cells, early, at about the time that the LGN input is arriving to the cortex, the cortical cells are actually being driven. So the probability of a spike by any of these patterns is higher than uniform, but they're not orientation selective. And then with time, the orientation selectivity develops. Now, we showed something like this in our 97 paper, but much weaker, because we didn't have the blanks at that point. So we couldn't see what was going on in this early phase, which I pointed out to you, because these were probability distributions, so we had no baseline to compare them to. But here, this shows that, in fact, in some of these early responses, and particularly in the input layers, there's a lot of non-oriented excitation, which then later becomes tuned. Within, you know, two synaptic delays, we're getting... Now, this could be due, this selectivity that's developing with time, over the course of 20 milliseconds, could be due to inhibition, or recurrent inhibition, or recurrent excitation, or both. In fact,
it still goes up. It is not going down.
Well, there's some activity going up here, but there's some activity coming down here. So this could be, you know, compared to this one, here it's just, this could be excitation, but this business here could be due to inhibition, is what I'm saying. That there's both. What? Sorry?
It cannot be only inhibition.
Yes, you're right. We're not plotting this in the right scale. Yeah, so this is right. Well, what this is showing is probability of firing a spike. So the solid curve is probability of firing a spike. And this is the blank is the probability of a uniform screen firing a spike.
So it should add up to 1.
So this plus this should add up to 1. Well, this probability plus all these probabilities should add up to 1. That is true. But if we forget about probability for a second and just think of this as a baseline. The problem is that this isn't plotted where this baseline is all at the same fixed level, so it's difficult to compare them. But
the scale
is different in different graphs. It's unfortunate. Instead of having this as a fixed probability, which it should, it isn't. But in any case, I think that you're right, Misha, that this enhancement in the middle is likely due to excitation, but we don't have we're not pinning it down with these experiments. But what we can say is that for certain, I mean that is independent of the scale, is that the early input in many of the neurons is not tuned, which is interesting, and is very different from the Thorpe and so on view. And the reason is because, again, what happens is that they don't see any of this stuff, because they're really looking at when the spikes come above threshold in a situation where they're sitting way below threshold. Whereas here, all of these measurements are made with the cells sort of basically firing most of the time, so that we're avoiding the threshold problem that is bedeviling a lot of the other experiments, I would say.
But how many spikes are there between the first frame and the second frame?
That's not the right way to think of this. These are averages over the whole of 15 minutes worth of spiking. So on the average, there'll be, you know, no spikes. There'll be 0.2 spikes between here and here. But what we're doing is calculating the delays based on the average over many different presentations where there's asynchrony between the spikes and the frames. Look, these measures are derived, these are correlation measures, derived over the whole spike train. So each of these graphs, each graph in here has, you know, something like 10,000 spikes.
Yeah, I understand that. But if you think of, if you want to think of this as a dynamical network, though, would you think that you have to have spike to have change, right?
Well, but it has to, but... Well, but to cause the response of this neuron to change, it's not just that we imagine, it's not just the spikes in this own neuron, but all the neurons around it. And they're all, you know, there are millions and millions of neurons, and they fill in all the gaps. Because each of them, although each one of them is only firing at 20 spikes a second, you know, multiply that by a million, and it's 20 million spikes, so it's a lot. the neuron we're looking at is only sampling all of its synaptic input, you know, at 10 spikes a second or something. But each spike is at a different time with respect to the input, so we can measure all these correlations with great accuracy. You know, we measure a 40 millisecond offset with something like 10,000 spikes. I mean, each of those spikes allows us to look at what the input was 40 milliseconds before it.
So this is a pretty broad cell.
Right, so this is it's a 4C alpha cell.
If you look at the sharpest plot, can you also see initial period where it's not too...
So the answer is we've just begun looking at these data now, actually, because of Förster and his paper in Nature Neuroscience. And the answer is that in some of them you see early sharp tuning, and others you see this. You can see both. And we don't have... So we're trying to analyze those data, you know, this week.
Some cells are tuned to be from the beginning.
Right, but the thing is, the beginning isn't always as early as this. So some of these sharply tuned cells only begin here. And they may be getting input from this guy, for instance. So another issue is, let's go back just for a second to this. I want to point this out from the data. If you look at these cells, it isn't immediately obvious, but they don't always begin at the same times. These two begin at 30 and 40. This one begins at 35. This one begins at 40. This one begins at 50. And notice where the peaks are. So this was embedded in this latest slide, but let me just show you. Here, the peak tuning is at around 80 milliseconds. Here, the peak tuning is at about 50 milliseconds. It can be very different depending on the layer and how sharply tuned the neuron is. And so some of these neurons that start out to be sharply tuned may be second-order neurons that are getting input from other neurons that did the work of doing the selectivity and then are passing it on to the next level, but you're not seeing it in the neuron at the higher level neuron.
I think that if you got cells which are nearby, they will have a tuning time course in the neuron?
Yeah, you would think so. But haven't done that. Now I want to zip to something else, completely different, for a second. So this is just another one of these examples. This is actually from the paper that Pugh et al. From 2000. This is one of the examples. It's a 4B neuron done also with this. So this is not a 4C alpha neuron. It's a 4B neuron done with this technique. And see here, it sort of looks a little bit tuned to begin with. You don't see the big elevation. At the very early. But then remember, we're only looking at 45 milliseconds here because the response isn't beginning at this early time scale that you see in 4C alpha. Okay? And again, you see nicely here that there is inhibition which goes quite wide in orientation at these early times, and then at later times it looks like it's more localized. So here, for instance. So there seems to be, and again, this hasn't been analyzed, but there seems to be evidence for both a global kind of suppression and also local, and you can get both. And you can see even in one neuron, stuff that looks very global here, which then becomes rather more localized at later times. I mean, here the inhibition is confined to this from here to here, whereas at these early times it's actually going all the way across. So anyway, using this technique, we think that we can actually study suppression and excitation and how they... And these, we presume, are cortico-cortical effects, which are affecting the orientation selectivity. Let me just go on for a second and do something else, which is sort of neat. I just wanted to finish up with something cute. So this is a recent project that that Ringach initiated using our data, but analyzing it in a different way. And here, he made it... the analysis was of responses of neurons to a movie, but it was a much more interesting movie because in this movie, spatial frequency was allowed to vary as well as orientation. So this is like, it was a 2D movie instead of a 1D movie. And the same idea is apparent here. It's reverse correlation, except that here the gratings were allowed to have a whole range of spatial frequencies as well as orientations. And so what you can then get is not just a distribution which is like a tuning profile, but you get a tuning surface, which we can represent here, where positive responses are in red and negatives are in blue. I'm going to define this in a second, what this function is. But what we get is a distribution over a surface instead of just over a line.
The x component of the...
Yeah, so this is, let me just... Oh, good. So the definition of this R function, which is being plotted, is the log of the ratio of the probability at a particular spatial frequency, angle, and time to the probability of a baseline, where the baseline probability is taken from the high spatial frequencies when C is very large, because those are assumed to be as if they were for a blank field, because the cell doesn't respond to it. So the baseline data are taken from this perimeter of the Fourier plane. This is a Fourier plane, which is spatial frequency and orientation.
C is omega?
Yeah, omega is C, right. I thought C was a better, omega is sometimes confused with other things, so I improved it by putting C in, but it's just to confuse the enemy. And the baseline region is here, and you take the probability, so these are, you take the probability from this region and divide it into the probabilities of all the other regions and take the log of the ratio, and you get things that go positive and negative. And the positive regions are red, and the negative regions are blue. And the neutral regions are yellow, or bluish green. So this is a way of looking at orientation and spatial frequency selectivity simultaneously. And you use the same kind of approach. You're looking at these probability distributions calculated by reverse correlation in just the same way as you do it for orientation alone. And when R is greater than zero, you're getting enhancement above the baseline. And when R is less than zero, you're getting suppression below the baseline. Okay. And so these are data for 5 different cells. And time is going left to right. I hope that's okay with you guys. And these are in milliseconds. So those are millisecond snapshots of these tuning functions. And you can sort of see them evolving with time. And in some cases, the patterns are somewhat different. But you sort of get an idea of how the data look. And you see these cells, which are more selective using a circular variance metric, and these cells here, which are less selective using a circular variance metric. And what you find is that a lot of the cells look like this. They have a lot of suppression. That is to say, there's a lot of blue. And it also varies with time. You can sort of see it developing as time goes on. And in fact, what we did was, Dario took a measure of how deep blue the blue was, how strong the suppression got. And sort of above a certain amount of suppression, he called it a suppressed cell. So if it was like greater than, I think, a quarter of the peak response, he said that was one of the cells that had significant suppression, and if it was less than that, it was not. And then divided all of the cells up into those that had significant suppression in this experiment and those that didn't, like this. And it's interesting, actually, that they, if you do that, and if you look at it in terms of the dynamic responses or even steady state responses, the cells that have significant suppression tend to have lower circular variance, and the cells that have less significant suppression tend to have higher circular variance. So that there does seem to be a correlation, an empirical correlation in the data between presence of suppression away from the peak and selectivity. It didn't have to work out this way. That is to say, you could imagine that you could generate highly selective cells by feed-forward mechanisms alone. And the fact that you don't observe that is to say, the fact that you observe this correlation between suppression and circular variance, both for the dynamical and the steady state, means that the way the cortex is achieving high selectivity, however you might want to do it, you know, from first principles, is via some kind of suppressive mechanism with this off-peak suppression that's observed.
Why did you have to go to special frequencies to make the separation?
We don't. We could have done it all. We are also, it is possible to do it also with the orientation experiments alone. The reason for doing this is that I'm not showing you the spatial frequency data, but we also observed a correlation with spatial frequency. And the idea was to see if a single mechanism was doing both. But I was just bringing these data in for the orientation story. But indeed, what we intend to, and we should have, but you know, it's one of these things, we should have, but we can try to do this. Having found this here, it's almost certainly true that we're going to find it with just the orientation alone, and we're trying to do that also.
Cells which don't show this inhibition, you say...
So these, that's these cells.
So there are cells which don't...
Yeah, I mean, there are some that are... It's true that there are some that are sort of down in the respectable orientation selectivity. It's true.
They don't have any inhibition. So the response never goes down with... What do you think that they don't have? How do you distinguish? The response always goes down eventually.
Well, the thing is there a suppression below the baseline?
Never go below the baseline.
Yeah.
At no orientation, at no time, they go
right.
down.
Right. Yeah.
That so means that they don't receive an inhibition.
Right. So it's an empirical definition as opposed to a mechanistic one. So in fact, it may be that there is hidden inhibition. You're right. But the fact that even so, this is such a strong result. I mean, I agree that there are some cells down here. It's not perfect, but the whole tendency. So, you know, these are steady-state experiments. They're not even the same experiment. And it's a very strong result, I think. These are steady-state experiments. The drifting gratings for 4 seconds. Yeah, it's a completely different experiment. Same cells. Yeah. So we thought that was pretty nice, actually, as in indicating that there is a linkage between suppressive mechanisms and selectivity. And... And the other thing I should say, this is just alluding to some of the theoretical work that I've done with Mary and with Dave McLaughlin and Mike Shelley, is that a lot of these dynamical features you don't get in feed-forward models. You don't get the Mexican hat type features. You don't get, which is something that Mary showed. And you don't get the development of selectivity with time. And in particular, if you look at, so this, these little dots here, this is like, this is an empirical curve, one of these circular variances as a function of time. And this is the prediction of this large scale model that McLaughlin and Shelley, let me finish, that McLaughlin and Shelley published about. And then the dotted curve here, that's actually what you would get from the geniculate input to a cortical cell with the cortical-cortical interactions turned off. That is to say, it's the Hubel-Weisel model with leakage. And what you can see is that in the reverse correlation experiment, even more than in the steady-state drifting grading experiment, the Hubel-Weisel model predicts very little selectivity. And the reason is, and the reason why it's even more than, is because you've removed the threshold. In these experiments, because you're always driving the cell above the threshold no longer can sharpen you. It can't bring down the response in the wings. And so in the reverse correlation experiment, that's really where you can see how pitiful is the selectivity of the feed-forward excitation model alone. Now, you can, of course, add inhibition, as in Ken Miller's model and so on, and Ken Miller could try to predict these kind of results also. But what I'm saying is, if you just think of feed-forward alone, that's what you would get. I think that's an important issue to understand, is that you don't get, when you're driving the cell above threshold with something like a reverse correlation experiment, or like these reverse correlation experiments anyway, the selectivity that you expect in the steady-state experiments due to the spike threshold goes away, and you have to then explain it some other way. And that's why these mechanisms of suppression and excitation from the cortex become important. So now your question. I'm sorry, I deferred it. Fred?
Just one. So this is the theoretical displays are from a large-scale network.
Yeah.
To this
right. Exactly. So this is the model's responses to correlation to this movie, and this is a 4C alpha cell actually. Selected to be, you know, similar to the model. Anyway, that's a joke. Anyway, so the conclusions I get from our results are that that orientation selectivity depends on both the pattern of thalamic input, and I say with that that the reason why it depends upon the pattern of thalamic input is mainly the setting up of the preference map. But then the selectivity depends very greatly on cortical-cortical interactions. And I think that really, these days, that's not a very controversial statement, that most people, I think, believe that. In our experiments, we believe that the evidence indicates that recurrent inhibition seems to be an important factor, and also that the selectivities for orientation and spatial frequency, as showed, are dynamic. They're changing with time, reflecting the time courses of the excitation and inhibition that the cells are receiving. So that the functional consequences of the dynamics are yet unknown, but I think that that's a rich area for exploration to try to look at how selectivity and perceptual discrimination and so on are dynamic. They're not just steady state things, which typically we measure them in a steady state manner, but we may be able to find techniques for measuring things dynamically that correspond with the dynamic measurements of the cells. And that might be interesting to try to make a link between the cellular physiology and perception. So there's lots of other, you know, things to talk about, but this, I just wanted to get straight this one issue about orientation selectivity and how the cortex is really very much involved in it, and the reasons for my view. So that's all I really have to say formally, although I'd be glad to keep on talking about it as much as you like.